Now we've got another clue, or a series of clues, to indicate that Sargon was pagan. And we find this in the pagan religion that he founded. The records show that the earliest forms of Babylonian religion that we can find, the earliest form, was monotheistic. They believed in one God. Whether it be the God we know or not, I'm not sure, but at least they had a God and not a multiplicity of them. And their religion contained a rather garbled but still recognizable version of the story of creation as given in the first chapter of Genesis. But about the time of Sargon, there developed polytheism. Pagan gods, the three chief ones, were Anu, Ea, and one whose name sometimes appears as Enlil, sometimes Molil. Now, by the myths told about these gods, you can determine the origin of it, because the myths about them would identify Anu as being Adam, Ea as Eve, and Molil or Enlil as Satan. Those you can recognize in these myths. Later, Molil becomes Bel or Baal, who is the chief god of Babylon and indeed became the most important of the pagan gods from there west clear to the Mediterranean coast. The pagan priests garbled things up somewhat in their legends, possibly intentionally. In a few of them, Ea is represented as a male, but most of these legends have Ea as a goddess, and as I say, identifiable by these myths as being Eve. Legends about the early form of Ea are exactly the same as the later legends about Ishtar. So, he had carried in then his own remembrance of the occurrences in his own early life, and then had decided to make gods of Adam, Eve, and Satan. In Sargon's own time, he was not deified. He founded pagan Satan worship, but he didn't promote himself up to the top. Later, he was deified. There are a few inscriptions that say, Sargon is my god. It's natural that among pagans, he should become a patron god of Babylon. Babylon's patron god, whose name appears in your King James Version usually as Merodach, although Marduk would be a more accurate transliteration of it. The name is derived from Marad, to rebel, and Cain was indeed a rebel. He is called, in their legends, the firstborn of Ea. Other legends say the eldest son of Ishtar, and Anu was his father. Cain was the firstborn of Eve. Merodach is the god of agriculture. Cain, you remember, was a tiller of the soil, whereas Abel was primarily a herdsman. The legends say that Merodach brought order out of chaos by separating land from water and founding homes for men. And we saw that Sargon, or Cain, reigned in this lower swamp land and directed the building of the dikes and drainage canals that separated the waters from the land enough that they could build more permanent cities. Now, 1 John 3, verse 12, recognizes that Cain was a son of the evil one. I know your King James Version doesn't use the word son because the translators had to meet accepted doctrine. In your King James Version, it says, we should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and slew his brother. If you will turn to the third chapter of the Gospel of Luke in your King James Version Bible, you will find that it gives the genealogy of Jesus Christ. It starts with Jesus Christ and works backward to Adam. Now, as you know, in your King James Version, where you find words printed in italic type, those are words which were not actually written in the original languages because they were implied or understood in those languages. The English does not imply it, and therefore, to make the English idiom conform to the idiom of the Greek or the Hebrew, they have supplied the word actually written out in English, which was understood in the earlier languages. Now take your King James Version and look up the genealogy of Jesus Christ. You will find that, let's start off with it here. Simpler to read it accurately than to just talk about it. It begins with verse 23, and Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli, which was the son of Nathat, which was the son of Levi, which was the son of Melchi, and so on down through verse after verse. And now you will note that beginning with the son of Heli, the words the son are in italic type, indicating they were not written out in the Greek. In other words, if you said John was of William, it meant in the Greek idiom, John was the son of William. Now, I've heard people try to deny on this 1 John 3:12 that spoke of any father and son relationship. Oh, it just meant merely that Cain was, you know, morally bad, like the evil one. Well, now, if that be a correct translation of the Greek, let's apply it to Luke and see if it's correct. I don't think that they developed a completely new and different Greek language between the writing of the Gospel according to Luke and the first epistle of John. Would it make sense to say Joseph, who was morally no better than Heli, who was just as bad as Nathat? Of course not. Too silly for words. Back in the first epistle of John, it's the very same Greek language, and it says Cain, who was the son of the evil one, and as a matter of fact, if you look it up in Weymouth's modern English translation, you'll find he translates it correctly. Cain, who was the son of the evil one. Furthermore, if you will look up the fifth chapter of Genesis, which gives the descendants of Adam, you will find that it nowhere lists Cain among them. It tells you who they were, and it doesn't list Cain. You know with what monotonous regularity the Bible says so-and-so begat who's this, and who's this begat such-and-such, and so forth. Verse after verse. You can't find me any place in the Bible where it says that Adam begat Cain, because he didn't. The first time it says Adam begat anybody is in the fifth chapter of Genesis, where it says, and Adam lived 140 years and begat a son in his own image and called his name Seth. Then people like to bring up the verse and try to make it mean something it doesn't say, which says that Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. Now, it records things that happened, but it does not once say that there was a cause and effect relationship. I can tell you with absolute truth that upon a certain evening I went to a movie, and the following morning the sun rose in the east. And I can prove it with witnesses. But I did not say that the fact that I went to the movie was the thing that caused the sun to rise in the east. And you wouldn't have believed me if I had said it. It is true, very true, that Adam and Eve had intercourse. It is very true that Eve bore Cain. But it is not true that Cain was the son of Adam, and the Bible does not anywhere say that Cain was a son of Adam. One of these ancient Akkadian inscriptions about Sargon, which uses the Akkadian form of his word, Sargani, says this: the divine Sargani, the illustrious king, a son of Bel, the just, the king of Akkad and of the children of Bel. Now you remember Bel or Baal was a later form of this obviously deified Satan, known in the earliest forms as Molil or Enlil. So here they recognize that Sargon was a son of what we know to be Satan. Other legends of Sargon's origin say he was adopted by Aki and raised as a gardener. Well, the basic root of that Aki is found in the Hebrew Nakash, meaning serpent, Naka, the Egyptian word for serpent, Naga, the Hindu word for serpent, particularly serpent god, the Ahi, a serpent water god, Ariman, the Persian devil, source of all evil. Cain, you remember, was a tiller of the soil. Sargon, raised as a gardener. One of Sargon's own inscriptions in our museum today says this: while I was a gardener, Ishtar loved me. He was still in the Garden of Eden, or not the Garden of Eden, but in this area to which Adam and Eve had gone. So you can identify the Cain of the Bible as an actual historical character, the records of whose own kingdom are in our museums today. Now we can carry it a bit farther. His own records show that at least three times he went to the Great Sea. At least once he crossed it. Now, what was that Great Sea? There are indications that it was the Atlantic. Because in Central and South America, there are legends in their mythology which cannot be accounted for on any basis except that they were brought over there by someone who knew the early mythology of Sargon's time. And in turn, you find in Babylonian religion the use of certain words and phrases that are Mayan. The story of the worship of Cain appears among the Mayas of Yucatan and the Quiches of Guatemala. The Mayas say that their kingdom was founded by King Can, and Can means serpent in their language. And a change from Cain to Can, from one language to another, is very small. But what we do today in our modern languages. The name which in English we call William is in French Guillaume. In German it's Wilhelm. In Italian it's Guglielmi. We make more change from one language to another today with the same word than they did in those days. This Mayan word Can means serpent. There was a family of seven, a father, mother, and five children. Their serpent king, his wife, and children symbolized by a seven-headed serpent. And incidentally, that same emblem of the seven-headed serpent is worshipped today in India and in Indochina and Siam, or Thailand as we call it now. This person who came and brought them this was deified in their legends as Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. A serpent having feathers instead of scales. Now their legends say that out of the east on white winged ships came white men who taught these Mayans their civilization and finally sailed away back to the east on these white winged ships saying, someday we will return. So ever since, They have worshipped as their god Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the white man who taught them their civilization. Now, it's a very interesting bit of more recent history that when Cortez landed on the shores of Mexico, he was received with practically no hostility. Out of the east in white-sailed ships came white men, obviously the promised return of Quetzalcoatl. He was greeted joyously with friendship. He had practically no difficulty marching on up to Montezuma's capital city, Mexico City, where he was greeted, as I say, with reverence and friendship. This was the promised return of Quetzalcoatl. Now, we know, of course, that he was nothing but a thief and a murderer there in search of loot. And the prisons of Spain had been emptied of the worst cutthroats to provide him with soldiers, because they were out to steal what they could get. They were accompanied, of course, by a couple of Spanish Catholic priests. And it's a matter of record in their reports that on one of the pagan festival days, these priests wandered into one of the pagan temples in Mexico City, and they observed the pagan priest putting on a Catholic mass, perfect in every detail, except it was not spoken in Latin. So the Catholic priest stormed out in a furious rage. "These pagans are mocking us." And so they incited the soldiers to a general massacre of the inhabitants, promising them in advance absolution for all the murders, rapes, and other crimes they might commit in the process. Now, what these Catholics didn't know was the fact that they got their ceremonies from the same ancient source as did the Mayans. That's a very interesting thing. If you want to trace it in great detail, get Hyslop's book, The Two Babylons, and you will see the Babylonian origin of so much of the Catholic ritual. You find among these people these ancient legends. Their legends say that one of Cain's sons, coveting the kingdom held by another of his sons, treacherously killed him, stabbing him in the back with a spear, and took his kingdom, which is probably their version of the murder of Abel by Cain, garbled somewhat down through the centuries. The Incas of Peru were probably Maya colonies, because the language of Peru, which was Quichua, shows their descent from the Quiches of Guatemala, and those were a branch of the Maya nation. Among other things that show how this culture was carried back and forth, in much of Central America, after the winter rains, comes the spring dry season. Then there are summer rains. Now, at the beginning of the month of May, at midnight, the Southern Cross constellation stands exactly perpendicular above the southern horizon, right in the meridian. And shortly thereafter, the next rainy season begins. So the natives recognize this as a sign that rain is coming soon. Now, the cross was a very ancient symbol among all nations. Now, the form in which we have it in Christianity today, with the crossbar going below the top of the vertical post, is a much later form. The earlier form of the cross was the Tau cross, the crossbar just resting on top of the vertical bar. You find that back in Egyptian records, for example, as far as you can find anything in Egypt. Now, the very name Tau is derived from Maya. T, A, and U, meaning literally here, water month. In other words, when the Southern Cross constellation stood exactly vertical above the southern horizon, right on the meridian, here was the beginning of the water month, the month when the rains would start. This is the month for rain. The month of May is named from Maya, the goddess, the good dame, the mother of the gods. So if you will go into Catholic religion, you will find this. The feast of the adoration of the Holy Cross is May 3rd, beginning of the water month. It is a day also consecrated particularly to the Mother of God, the Good Lady. In other words, straight out of Babylonian and Mayan paganism, which again we trace right back in its beginning to Cain or Sargon. The feast of the Nativity of St. John the Baptist is June 24th. Now in ancient Chaldea, this was the first day of the month of Tammuz, named after their pagan god Tammuz, who was the same as Nimrod or Bacchus, the god of pagan drunken debauchery, a great pagan day. Now among the ancients, the day began not at midnight as it does among us, it began at sunset. So the Catholics celebrate the Nativity of St. John, beginning with St. John's Eve, the night of the 23rd. Where do they get it? In Hebrew, the name which we have anglicized as John is Johannes. Now, one of the names given Bacchus was Oannes. Put a Y in front of that, Johannes. See how similar they are? On the rebirth of Bacchus, he came out of the sea as Oannes, probably again identifying him with their fish god, Dagon. You know, have you ever wondered when you read the book of Noah, how it was that Noah could go, or not Noah, Jonah, how it was that Jonah could go among these pagans and be believed, when the Hebrew prophets had such a hard time convincing anybody among their own people? God told him, you go to Nineveh and tell these people, if they don't speedily reform, I'm going to destroy them in their city. Jonah, being a good patriotic Hebrew, said, nothing doing. I know what those people do to us in their wars. I'm not going to save them. Let them be killed off. So he took ship for England. And you know the rest of it. The storm came up, he was thrown overboard, picked up by a great fish and delivered back to dry land. Quite a remarkable thing, and the news of which would be carried. And now into the city of Nineveh, which worshipped among other gods the fish god Dagon, here comes Jonah, delivered right out of the fish's mouth. This was evidence of authenticity. They were ready to listen to him. And you remember that while no Hebrew prophet ever got that quick reform out of any Hebrew city, he got swift results there in Nineveh, merely because they mistook who he was and where he came from. But it ties you back into this same sort of thing. Now, remember that Bacchus was the same as Tammuz. Tammuz also had the name Oannes. The beginning of the month of Tammuz, or Oannes, June 24th. The writings of the early Christian fathers show that Christianity was not making extremely rapid headway. They were making some converts, but so also were the pagan religions. And unfortunately, Every church falls into the hands of those who have a talent which is good when kept in its proper place, the organizers. And rarely does a great talent for organization go with a great appreciation of the Word of God. To the organizer, there is something in numbers. Why isn't the church big? Well, in the Catholic Church, you had some popes who felt the need of making more rapid progress in the way of numbers on this thing. Till finally, Pope Gregory the Great said, the trouble is, we're making it too hard for pagans to join the church. We emphasize the differences between the pagan religions and Christianity. They've got to abandon everything they believe in to come into this. Now, the way to recruit them in big numbers is, don't talk about the differences, talk about the similarities. It's an easy transition that way, and you'll get them in big numbers. Well, of course, you know what he did. He didn't Christianize the pagans, he paganized the Christians. Because he took over as many as possible of the pagan holidays and so on, so that the pagans would feel quite at home joining the Catholic Church. This is a matter of church record, and the writings of many of the early Christian fathers complain bitterly about these things, pointing out how much more loyal to their own religion the pagans were than the Christians, because the pagans would not adopt any Christian holidays, whereas the Christians were adopting pagan holidays and rituals. So here they took over the day of Oannes, and to give it and standing in the Catholic Church said, oh, it's the day of Ioannes, John the Baptist. Again, this was 6 months before the midwinter holiday, December 25th, which they had falsely taken over as the alleged birthday of Christ. You can trace the worship of the day of the rebirth of the sun, December 25th, at least 2,000 years B.C. And there is the clearest evidence in the Bible that Christ was not born anywhere close to December. You remember the shepherds were out in the fields with their sheep. Now that high ridge, he was born only a few miles from Jerusalem, you know. Just a moderate walk away from it. That high ridge they're on, they're up about 2,600 feet elevation. They get some snowfall in the winter. It gets distinctly cold. And the shepherds do not leave their sheep out in the fields and stay out with them in the winter, and never did. Their sheep are penned up at home, and the shepherds are in around the fire where it's warm. You can, of course, pretty well establish the birthday of Christ is October 4th. If you don't want to take a pagan holiday in preference to it. So, having decided that they would get more pagans into the fold if they adopted the birthday of the invincible Son as the alleged birthday of Christ, John the Baptist, the Bible tells us, born 6 months earlier, so here, Oannes or Ioannes Day, 6 months earlier, fine, name that after John the Baptist. So, the ancient religions here, which, as I say, we can trace not only in Babylonia, Sumer and Akkadia, but we can trace in Central and South America, show that Cain, known to history under the name of Sargon, is a real person. He's no myth. Today, I want to talk about the mystery of good and evil. From the earliest times, men have been puzzled by the fact that God allows evil to exist, and even to overthrow good very often. Almost the whole of the book of Job deals with this question. Job, suffering great affliction and knowing that he had done nothing to deserve it, still saw the wicked flourish. He said, I will say unto God, do not condemn me. Show me wherefore thou contendest with me. Is it good unto thee that thou shouldst oppress, that thou shouldst despise the work of thine hands, and shine upon the counsel of the wicked?
Wherefore do the wicked live, become old, yea, are mighty in power? Their seed is established in their sight with them, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God upon them. Well, we can't deny this. Evil men do flourish. They get all the cream of this life, while the good have much trouble and cannot keep those things which they themselves create. Why is this? The problem of good and evil confronted our race from its beginning. We were made for a purpose, to not only live by, but also to enforce the laws of God. Participation in the evils of the older races was not for us. Adam and Eve were told, "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." How Adam's original immortality was lost to him and to all of his descendants, we are not told. Perhaps by infection with some disease which left hereditary effects. But Adam did die within the prophetic day of 1,000 years from the time he participated in the evils of the older races. Evil was not new in the world when Adam and Eve were put here, but it was their job to curb it and to demonstrate good. The older races of Asia and Africa and India then, as they do today, worship devils, Satan and the fallen angels who followed him into rebellion. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament affirm this. Deuteronomy 32:17 says, "They sacrificed to devils, not to God, but to gods whom they knew not." And 1 Corinthians 10:20 says, "But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. And I would not that ye should have fellowship with devils." Satan was not a scaly snake wriggling along the ground, but a mighty angel. The word mistranslated serpent is the Hebrew word nokash, meaning enchanter or magician, which his angelic powers enabled Satan to be. Later, Satan's children, yes, I mean children, and followers, adopted the serpent as his emblem or symbol, and from this later tradition, the mistranslation came about. Satan told Eve, "In the day that ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as God, knowing good and evil." That is, now wouldn't you like to be worshipped as gods, as I and my followers are? I'll show you how. These people are a rough, tough lot. You poor innocents don't know how to get along with them. You have to be tougher than they are and know more about it than they do. That's how I make them worship me. But evil always brings eventual judgment. It was the cause of the catastrophes by which the ancient continents of Lemuria and Atlantis sank beneath great oceans. Our race was put here not to learn wickedness, but to compel everyone to stop it. Why were we left so susceptible to temptation? We are the children of God, created to become his companions. He could have made us mere robots who never sinned simply because they lacked the ability to do so. But then, wouldn't we have been a rather stuffy lot? He wanted children who were loyal and good, not just because they lacked the power to be otherwise, but because they were fine enough to choose loyalty and goodness. Satan and his followers had also been made with freedom to choose either right or wrong, and they abused that freedom before Adam was put on this earth. That didn't change God's mind. He still wanted his own children to have free will. Therefore, they had to learn the first lesson, the consequences of our own sins. True, God foresaw man's sins and made provision for his salvation before the foundation of the world. But still, man had to be allowed to suffer the consequences long enough to make the lesson effective. Do not be misled by another serious mistranslation in your King James Version of the Bible. The use of the word evil when the Hebrew word carried no such meaning. Many have been deceived by Isaiah 45:7, which in your King James Version reads as follows, "I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things." God never creates evil in the modern sense of the word, meaning wickedness. The Hebrew word used in that verse is ra, which means calamity, affliction, adversity, wretchedness, or sorrow, but it never means wickedness. What God said in the Hebrew is, I make peace and I create calamity. That is, calamity is a punishment for wickedness. But why do we need to have the lesson rubbed in so bitterly? Because far more than just our own conduct is at stake. We are eventually to be the administrators of God's kingdom over the whole universe. It will begin on this earth, of course. Remember that Revelation 2, verses 26 and 27 says, He that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. But it is even greater than this. Isaiah 9, verse 7 tells us that of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. And surely this one little planet has no room for perpetual increase. Hence, Jesus Christ also says in Revelation 3, verse 21, To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame, and am set down with my Father in his throne. And that throne rules the whole universe. So one of the first lessons we must learn is that which our leaders today so willfully violate, that there cannot be any such thing as peaceful coexistence of good and evil, for one must inevitably destroy the other. Adam's job was to attack, defeat, and expel Satan. Instead, he tried peaceful coexistence, and you are paying the penalty of it today. One example of this folly, of course, is trying to coexist with communism. But another is trying to coexist with crime, with greed, with low standards of character. Why do we have so many robberies, burglaries, murders, and rapes? Because we don't get rid of the kind of people who do these things. The Bible repeatedly warns us not to let such people live. The book of Deuteronomy lists many offenses, including habitual crime, for which God positively commands the death penalty, not allowing any alternative, each time saying, So shalt thou put the evil away from among you, and those which remain shall hear of it, and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. But instead we let professional sob sisters get us all worked up emotionally over the plight of the poor criminal, although I have never once heard one of these characters get sentimental over the troubles of the victim who was robbed or murdered. We coddle our criminals, we make sure that we always keep a good supply of them on hand, and then we wonder why we have lots of crime. Then there is also that race of people who make it always harder for us to earn a living. They stick together, they gain control of one industry and trade after another, until today we can't buy food or clothing, medicine or furniture, until it has passed through their hands and had the price raised. They reduce us to slavery economically, just as surely as communism, led by these same people, would enslave us by force. And they are already treating us as slaves in our own land, forbidding us to mention the name of Jesus Christ in our schools, using their wealth, their tightly organized group power, their mastery of the smear technique to control our politicians and make them oppress the great white Christian majority in the interest of admitted minority groups. They are treasonably plotting to destroy our national independence and make us just a conquered province of a world government under the United Nations, in which the black, brown, and yellow races would rule us as their slaves. You suffer from the effects of all these things. That is what you're complaining about. You suffer from their crimes, you are cheated by their greed, you are losing your freedom to choose the companions among whom you will live and raise your children. You have lost your economic freedom, and you're fast losing your political freedom. And you ask, why does God permit all this evil? He permits it because you permit it. Don't wait for God to come down from heaven and put the lid on the garbage can. That's your job. So also, it is your job to put an end to evil by putting an end to the evil people who live among us. The mystery is Why have we waited so long to do it?